And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3692 of the Survival Podcast. And today is a Monday. It's Monday, June the 23rd, 2025. We got a lot to talk about. This is really a listener feedback show, but, you know, I don't hate money and I do love listeners showing up for live feed. So I learned a long time ago, don't call a listener feedback show a listener feedback show because people tend not to show up. Talk about the topics in the title. So the title of today's episode is Bahams, Bitcoin, Mushrooms, and More. And that might sound like a big claim, but we're going to deliver on all of it. We're going to lead off, which is what I know most of you will show up for today. Gloom and doom. The orange man done went and bombed Iran. Iran is kind of pissed. If somebody dropped bombs on your shit, you'd be pissed too, especially really expensive nuclear shit. But what happens next? This will not be a huge long segment. It's a little clickbaity. I'm sorry. I got to get you guys to show up somehow. But we got a ton to cover today. And I'm going to talk. I actually gamed it out with AI a little bit, and it went mostly where I thought it would. Mostly. It's an interesting thing. And I also picked up some interesting scuttle off of social media with the way that Iranians could close the Strait of Hormuz, and I ran that through AI, and they said, yeah, that's not going to work. So we'll talk about that. Governor Abbott signed his second veto this year, and it's only his first full veto of a bill. The other one was a line item. I don't think the man vetoed a damn thing otherwise. I think it's like his only veto, and it's a good one, right? And he went against his own party. And I think it was a very smart move for a variety of reasons. I'll tell you what it was all about. For those who don't know, Governor Abbott is my governor of the state of Texas here. This is actually a national implication, I think, in some ways, because, there's a few states that set a lot of precedent for the whole country. And they're not necessarily like one side of the aisle either. I mean, you got California is as blue a state as it gets. New York is blue a state as it gets. You got Florida and Texas are red states. It's more because of the total population and the impact on national consumer spending and policy sets by corporations in response to regulations, right? So we'll tell you about that. Stablecoin bill is a law. We called this the Genius Act. I talked about this a lot. And now the Secretary of Dissent is saying exactly what I said about the reasoning behind it and how it's going to help with the national debt. Do I think it'll fix the debt? No, but I do think it's another can kick. And it's going to work out exactly like I have foretold. Every once in a while, several times a week, I feel like Emperor Palpatine from Star Wars. Everything is happening as I have foreseen. Then I have some feedback from a young lady, a 17-year-old young lady that read Laws of Life because her father gave her a copy. I just want to read what she had to say about it. Then we're going to talk a little bit about some like homestead topics and stuff like that today. First thing I want to do, though, I'm going to give you an update on the boom room, right? The boom room sounds, somebody said, I thought it was pornographic when I saw the first post. Now, the boom room 2 is a mushroom growing tent. I put out a couple of videos on it, one yesterday. I'm going to show you the difference between the growth of these Italian oyster mushrooms yesterday versus today. And I will be eating them today. I thought I'd have one more day. No, these things have gone boom, just like the promise. And before we go into more topics on some homesteading stuff, we're going to talk about some Bitcoin topics. First of all, last week I answered a question for a guy. How do I buy Bitcoin? The basic five-step program. I didn't realize that he actually stated he didn't want to use his bank account. I'm going to tell you why you need to drop that. Just drop it. And I'm going to ask why people think they need to do this. And I'll give you one way to do it without a bank account if you really want to. If you really, really want to, there is a way to do it with two big name brands. So it's not like a backdoor thing or something like that. It's still got a KYC record. Okay. But it would fulfill not taking money from my bank account for whatever reason that person. And I asked them, I said, I answered this question for you last week. I saw from my bank account. I let the word not out because I think that's foolish. Texas also now has a Bitcoin reserve, first state in the union to do so. So we'll talk about that. I think that's going to be a really cool thing. And I think it's going to lead to more states doing it. I have an interesting question. Jack, if Bitcoin hits $1 million, if it was basically, I said, if it was $1 million right now, I could retire right now. So I don't know if that means he has one Bitcoin and thinks he can do it on $1 million, or he has 10, and obviously $10 million you could retire pretty well in this country on, you know, with some strategic planning, you could really do well with that amount of money. But he's like, well, you know, if Bitcoin 10Xs, does that mean inflation 10Xs? And if gas was $30 a gallon right now instead of $3, I couldn't retire with what I have in Bitcoin. It's an interesting question. It's very flawed in its reasoning, though, and I'll explain why. If you already have Bitcoin outside of a 401 or IRA and you're already buying it, you don't have the first question, but you have an IRA or a 401k where you can buy the ETFs, should you or should all your future purchases stay outside of there? I don't think this is an either or. I think this is an also, and I'll explain my reasoning for that when we get there. And then why do I think, but most of the, you know, but what if blank happens, Bitcoin objections are based on willful ignorance. So this is, I just did an interview with Billy Bond, and there was a couple of his listeners, touchy-feely types, who got really, really upset about my comments to somebody at the end of the episode that was, what good is Bitcoin if the grid goes down? And you know how stupid I think that question is. I don't really think it's stupid, though. I think it's ignorance. Because the person that asked that question wasn't stupid. I could tell by some of the other questions she had asked. And I was accused of attacking her and mocking her, and I did. I actually said that I think this person's asked some really smart questions today. And but this one isn't one of them, and here's why. But I'm going to tell you why I think all of it is willful ignorance. They're going to ban it, whatever, right? It's willful ignorance. And willful ignorance means a lack of knowledge, not stupidity. Those are different things. But it's an intentional ignorance. Like, your ignorance is totally curable. You know that it's curable, and you have made a conscious decision not to cure your own ignorance. Because the same person that says, well, what if the grid goes down? They have a 401k with a bunch of ETFs in it. What good are those if the grid goes down? And what does that mean? And for how, like, it's just, I'll get to it when I get to it. Then we got some, like, more homesteady type questions, right? I got one on using spent mushroom blocks in your garden. Another on developing a good mixture ratio with biochar wood chips and rabbit pellets. And how to get rid of sand spurs on your property without using chemicals, which I know exactly how to do because I exactly did it. You can't find one here now. And those of you who used to come to this property for workshops and such years ago, you guys know that there wasn't just a few of them here. There used to be people posting pictures of their clothing and their gear 6 months after a workshop, still finding sand spurs in them. And now there's none. What happened? How did I do that? Did I just let nature do it? Did I just improve fertility? Improving fertility was part of it, but there was another piece to it that is actually really important that's more mechanical. And it's properly timed mechanical control, but we never used a single, and I mean not a single spritz of a chemical on this property in the way that the word means. I know somebody's out there, you know that water is a chemical, right? Yes, you know what I mean. And people like that today, I'm in no mood. If I get somebody like that today, if I get somebody like the well actually guy in the meme with the glasses, the big fat guy, well actually, I'm just going to ban you. I'm going to ban you permanently, don't worry, but you're just done for the episode. I don't have time for that crap today. I'm not in the mood, trust me. All right, so before we do all that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone. At Above Phone, you can take back your tech and your privacy. You can do that with three specific devices, the Above Phone, the Above Book, and the Above Tablet. And if you're like, I'm not technical, Jack. I don't know if I can migrate over to these other technologies. They will give you an expert who will walk you through the onboarding process to your new device. And when you start using it in a couple days, you won't even, it'll be the same. Like, I'll tell you what, it's no harder than being a PC person your whole life. Because I have a PC over here where I'm pointing, right? Where my hands are, right over there. There's a PC. And I've used a PC 90% of my adult life. About 10 years ago, I started adding a Mac to my life. And I have different things that I do with different devices, MacBooks, Above Books, you know, PCs, etc. And when you first start using a Mac, and you've used a PC, it's a little different here and there. It's no big deal, though. It doesn't take long to pick it up. With a bug phone, you can do something that's not going to happen with a PC or a Mac, though. Keep your things that you want private, private, all your data private, and have access to apps that aren't tracking you either. Plus, if you need to use an app, you can put it in jail. And you only let it out of jail when you need to use it, so it's not running some background bullshit and reporting on you when it's going on. So check out abovephone.com today. And remember, they do a discount for MSB members, a really good one, $75 off any phone at abovephone.com. Next up, the Wealthsteading Podcast with John Pugliano. And I realized a couple weeks ago, you know, whenever you talk about John, you never tell people, like, one of the coolest things you can do with his Wealthsteading Podcast is not just get the podcast. It's you can go over to wealthsteading.com and you can click on buy and sell alerts, and you can fill out this little form here where it says learn more. And when you fill that out, you can subscribe right here, and you will get about once every 2 weeks kind of updates to what John is actually doing with his money and his clients' money. And that's a great insight. You know, that's the thing, right? Whenever I tell you about stuff, I always try to say, like, I know this works because I've done it. I know this works because I'm doing it, or I think this will work because I've researched it. Those are very different things. When somebody says, what blank would you recommend for blank? And when I say, well, this is what I use, that's the strongest endorsement you're going to get. What I chose for myself is what I'm recommending for you. That's what John's offering you with the buy and sell alerts, and I really recommend that you check those out. So now let's get into it. Let's just jump into the part you guys all really showed up for. You saw the thumbnail. You saw Trump standing there looking at the red screens and all the world blowing up. Yeah. Jackson, tell us about World War III. I'm going to tell you that World War III is not even on my radar for this. People saying that are in two camps. One, Looney Tunes that like to be afraid, that always think it's World War III. Ukraine was also the same people who told you Ukraine would be World War III. Those people, right? The same people that every time anything happens everywhere, it's going to be World War III. My grandson asked me about this today, and I'm like, if you were my age or your grandma's age, you would have at some point in your life by now, multiple times, hidden under a desk at school for a drill for World War III. And back then, there was actually probably a possibility of it actually being a thing. And I'm not saying that could never happen any, you know, from here ever again, but United States and Iran, World War III now. This is just dumb. I'm going to put that on the shelf. If you want to drag it off the shelf, you go ahead. I'm not even going to go there. But let's just talk about what happened, right? So Top Gun 2 happened, right? Which is the original Star Wars movie happened. We got this evil place, and we went down a shaft, and we blew some shit up, and now the world is saved, and the Empire has been knocked back on its heels, right? It's the same shit over and over again. And propaganda is real, and real is propaganda at the same time. So my opinion of whether this should have been done or not is absolutely 100% irrelevant. Now, those of you that have been around a while, you probably know what my opinion is. And you either agree with it or you don't. But I'm not even gonna talk about that today, because my opinion doesn't matter. And your opinion of my opinion doesn't matter. And because none of our opinions are going to have any impact at all on what has happened or what is going to happen going forward. You can love the orange man and believe all the propaganda and swallow it down like a baby bird swallowing mama bird's puke, or you can say it's all a false flag or whatever else you want to say. And you know what? You will have zero impact on what has happened and what is going to happen with your opinion. So it's not worth worrying about. I am not concerned about whether it should have happened or not now. I had my opinions before it happened. At that point, at least your opinion sort of kind of in the ether of the nebulous world of existence matters. But now that it's happened, doesn't it matter what you think should have happened, right? The question is, what is going to happen next? So it's very clear that I think Trump at least believes his own bullshit, that he believes I can send in the U.S. air power, demonstrate our aerial and tactical supremacy, which is superior. This is my opinion now, but I feel this way. It is legitimately superior to what any other nation is even close to being able to do. That the ability that we have to strike targets like that in that scenario, that way, that effectively, yes. And so he knows that more than I do, because he knows more than I'll ever know and more than you'll ever know. And some of the time, as much as I hate government, we have to realize there are things that people at the top know that you're never going to know because they can't tell you. There's also the problem that some of what they know ain't so because the people underneath them tell them what they want that guy at the top, the one that can push the button, what they want him to hear and how they want him to act. And Trump, like anybody else, is susceptible to that shit. But it's very clear to me that he believed he could do this. And the Ayatollahs would blah, 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 and threaten some shit and maybe even do a little bit, but not really. He could make it a one and done and say, look, when you're ready to talk peace again, let's talk peace. By the way, if you FA while this is all going on, you're going to FO again, even worse than before. And that whatever they did to FA would be minor compared to how much more FO had to come out. Right. That's his belief. That doesn't necessarily work for Iran. Right. And this isn't pro-Iranian. This is just who these people are. They are the kind of people, when you hit them, they are going to hit you back in some way. And there are multiple ways that they can hit back. The only real strategic move they have right now, though, they already said they're doing, and they've already said they've done, but we'll see, is to block the Strait of Hormuz. So here's your geography lesson for those of you that relied only on public school to tell you things and you're, let's say, under 30, right? There's this place called the Red Sea. This guy Moses supposedly parted it at one time. The Israelis walked across it, you know, that place, right? And to get oil to different parts of the world, ships go up that Red Sea to a place called the Suez Canal. And they pass through the canal, and then they can come out into the Mediterranean or go from the Mediterranean out to the other side of, like, the Indian Ocean and get around to China and what have you. And this allows massive amounts of commerce to occur throughout the world, and it's not just oil. But oil is the strategic asset that is most concerning in that pinch point. And if you don't do that with something like oil, which is bulky and heavy, right, then the only other way to transport it, if it needs to go from one side to the other, is around the Cape of Africa. And this is very expensive and much longer in duration to get done. Yeah? So that's the situation. There's a point of that strait off the Iranian coast that's only about 2 miles wide, where the channel is deep enough that ships, cargo ships, can go in and out. And what Iran's saying, we'll mine it, we'll shut it down. You will not be able to pass through. Get ready for $8 a gallon gas because you had to go blow up our shit. And what Arjban is saying, I told you if you FA, you're going to FO again and you ain't going to like it. So what will probably happen is they may do it, and U.S. military assets will be deployed on that. That will be at least have the pseudo effect of Trump saying, this is not a U.S. problem. This is a global problem, right? Like, every nation in the world depends on shipping going through that strait, period. It's like one of the only, like, nuclear buttons, hopefully, that Iran has, yeah? So they have to do it, but yet they can't get away with doing it very long because I'm going to be abundantly clear here. If we really want to, that strait can be wider really fast. I mean, we could literally, like, blow the strait wider if we wanted to. I'm not advocating anything. I'm just saying that. And any Iranian assets deployed into that region for the purpose of shutting down the strait will be lit the F up. And I mean lit the F up. And, you know, here Kevin's saying China's warning Iran not to shut it down too. So what China's like is, no, we don't like America in this situation at all. We agree. But you can't F and do this. So this is the only move they have in terms of the whole world on them. So what are their other options? One person said on social media, and I thought it was interesting, it's not that deep. They could literally take like one or two of their own ships out there, big ones, big, like even old cargo ships, and scuttle them to the bottom and block the strait that way. There would be nothing to blow up. Yeah, see, the problem is we actually have equipment to deal with that eventuality, and it would take more than a couple ships. It's a 2 mile wide swath, so only the biggest, deepest channel running ships would even be affected by this attempt. And again, we're back to what? China, like, don't you do it, right? If they did that, they have a lot of the world on their side right now, believe it or not, right? Not everybody believes the American hegemony. You want to lose that diplomatic edge, go ahead and do that and see what happens. Not to mention the U.S., if we wanted to, can supply all the oil that we need for ourselves out of our own hemisphere. We don't need any other shit. It would drive up pricing globally, but there's actually things that could be done to mitigate that here at home. So Iran could help hurt themselves harder with this, right, than not doing anything at all. They might, but they can't not do anything at all. And the reason they can't do anything at all is, you know, all of this shit, like all we have to do is we blow enough stuff up. The army will do a coup. They'll throw the Ayatollahs into a pit somewhere, maybe the one we made. And then democracy and freedom will reign in Iran is nonsense, right? A country to fall into a theocracy the way that Iran did at the time has to have a tendency toward it in the first place. Okay, you can't control a nation with the population in tens of millions with that type of small autocratic group unless there's a significant amount of the population willing to go along with it. That doesn't mean that their hold is absolute and that they're not going to be able to do anything about it, right? Like, I'm sorry. It doesn't mean that they're not at risk, is what I was trying to say. I got distracted again by a comment. So what I mean by that is there are people in Iran that want those guys gone. There's a lot of Iranian people, especially young people, that even though that they kind of actually dig the idea of Sharia law, there's Sharia law and then there's like Sharia law light. And they might be more of the light variety. There's a lot of people that don't like the fact that you can literally end up in prison for years because you didn't wear your clothes the right way, especially if you're a woman. They're not hip on that. So there is a constant threat to overthrow not so much the state government, but the theocratical component of the state government. And these guys are the supreme leaders, right? So you've got it's a lot like a shared governed monarchy, where you have like the royals at the top and then like a government of sorts, a parliament of sorts with a president underneath that, not what England has today where the monarch is a figurehead, but where the monarch actually has more power and more control than a subordinate body of government underneath it, except instead of it being a monarch, it's a council of these Ayatollahs, right, with a supreme leader who would be like the, you know, the king, I guess would be a way to look at it. Those guys do not want to lose power. And so what they've done is the people in that subordinate body of government, they made sure a lot of the key players in it are on their side. They don't want to lose power either. That doesn't mean there's not an underbelly. And even if you don't think it's there, they think it's there. Even if it's not there, they think it's there. And they are a paranoid regime that does not want to lose power. And they definitely don't want to get like, oh, I don't know, drugged through the streets, shot and stabbed, and hung off of a building or something. Like, you know, let's just say has happened before, right, to other people who have stood up to the American hegemony. So if they don't do anything, right, if they don't do anything at all, then they look weak. If they do too much, they invite more of this firepower, which I assure you, I don't care what your favorite commentator from alternative media told you, they cannot stand against U.S. firepower, period. And again, I'm talking about Orange Man firepower. I'm not talking about Bush firepower because we got to stop this shit too. But Trump, for all his flaws, is not Bush 2.0. You will not see a land-based invasion of Iran by U.S. forces. There's not enough political will behind the Orange Man for him to do that, and I don't think he wants to. So what I'm talking about is standoff destruction. There is nothing they can do to stand against it, and they will lose every bit of ability to stand against anything, which is part of why they want a nuke in the first place. Because once you have nukes, turns out we stop poking you, right? So what I see coming forward is likely Ibadel here said Iran bombed U.S. bases. I don't know if he means in the past, like 2 hours ago since this happened. I'm not sure. But I would expect there will be some missile strikes on some U.S. bases, very much like when Arjman blew up Soleimani, where like they hit one of our bases in Iraq. But like they hit the east side of the base And we knew they were going to hit the base, and we kind of went like, okay, guys, you got to hit back. We understand. Go ahead. Right? Or he says just now. So, yeah. Okay. So, now, it depends on what that means. It's massive destruction. Effective attack. Bullshittery. I don't know yet. I'm not going to comment on something that I don't know. I said Iran hit al-Assad today, which is okay. So now we have to see what the escalation game will do, going back and forth. I do not think it'll go very far, and it may in fact be the case that if they did an attack that looks a lot like what happened after Soleimani, remember what the U.S. did after that? They didn't do anything. They talked like they were going to do something. They didn't do it. That gave the Iranians, like, there is a political gamesmanship that's done in these situations. They know we don't want to, like, totally take over their country. No, that's like poop on a stick. Get it away from me, right? They also know that they've come up against somebody, again, love them or hate them. Okay, Adrian says there was some videos just now from Doha or something, but it wasn't confirmed so far. So until somebody actually knows, like, the extent of the damage, I'm not going to comment on it, because I'm just going to get, you know, sidetracked by that. So we'll see. But I personally think there'll be some back and forth, enough for them to try to save face, and then we're going to go back to the way things have been. That's what I think is going to happen. But when I say that and you think, oh, no big deal, that could take 6 months to a year. We just don't know. We just don't know. But they have to, you understand, they have to do something. They have to do something to maintain control of their own country internally. So, World War III? Nope. U.S. troops on the ground in Iran? Nope. Nope. One wild card. There is a potential sleeper cells, proxies, terrorist attacks, hacking, cyber attacks. Mainly the cyber attacks that Iran would engage in would not be, we're going to shut down the U.S. electrical grid, because if you want your ass fried into oblivion, that would be how to do that, with total justification by the global community. No, it'd be more like the pipeline shutdowns of the past and all. They don't actually attack the infrastructure. They attack things like the billing software for the infrastructure. And then they ransomware, because that way they get money out of it too. I would be on the lookout for that. I am a little bit concerned about like sleeper cells or inflamed individual would-be terrorists using this as impetus to move. My bigger concern is, yeah, I'm going to say the word, the false flag potential. There are people in our government. I mean, Lindsey Graham looks like he's pleasuring himself in front of a Fox News monitor every 5 seconds right now. It's like his whole life, all he's wanted to see is Iran turned into a mushroom cloud. And there's a lot of these people in our government. One of the reasons I was so opposed to Nikki Haley isn't because I think Donald Trump is a better president. This is a thing. It's because when Vivek said about her, she'll send your kids to war in a place she doesn't even know how to find on a map so she can buy a bigger house, I agree with him. Agree with Vivek 100% on that. And there's a lot of people like that in our government. Most of them, you do not know their names. They're inside organizations like the NSA. They're inside organizations like the CIA. And I see you guys on my weblogs. I see you guys. I know you're there. I see you. You know, I don't know what you think you're doing, but you're not that good at it, right? I know some of y'all listen. Maybe you're actually trying to learn something. I don't know. But there are people like that in those entities. And what they won't do is put together a bunch of, like, Navy SEALs or Delta Force or something, dress them in black, and have them go do the deed and try to blame it on the bad guys. They won't do that. But they do know where some of these groups are, and it is possible that someone somewhere that's handling them in an attempt to sting could get them to act, because if you have a legitimate, high visibility, serious attack on U.S. soil, and it even looks like, if it even smells like Iran did it, then you get full-scale support for all-out war against Iran. That's the wild card. That's what we have to watch out for. And I do feel like I should be wearing a shirt instead of talking about tar and feather that says, we interrupt your life to bring you false flag season. I have that vibe. I just hope I'm wrong. I just hope that I'm wrong. But I think even that, what you get is the U.S. doing to Iran what Israel did to Gaza. I don't think you get a single boot on the ground. I just don't. As for Trump talking about regime change, I know I'm not one that gives passes to people very often in government. I think when Trump mentioned that comment, I think what he meant is, I don't know, if I lived in Iran, I think I'd want to get rid of the people that are in charge right now because they're not doing anything good for the country. So I think it's more of how that statement should be taken. Let's move on to a politician who I kind of have like a he's all right, I hate him relationship with. He's my governor, Greg Abbott. This doesn't change who he is at all. The guy you're going to see in the picture initially is a guy I really hate. Even though I was glad to see him beat impeachment, his name is Dan Patrick. He's our lieutenant governor. And he is the sleazeball that was really behind this. Texas, our legislature passed a bill that would ban all THC products in the state of Texas, including those that are hemp-derived and legal under the federal law, under the federal legislation. Under X percent, and they must be derived from hemp, not cannabis that we think of that we all used to smoke back in the 80s watching Cheech Chong movies. Abbott waited till the last minute, and I think that was a strategic move. I think if he had announced he was going to do it before he was ready to do it, that there would have been a big pushback. He vetoed the bill. And I am so grateful that he vetoed this bill. Patrick is convinced that things like this right here, Chili Country Cannabis Seasoning Mix, which, by the way, this particular product here won't do anything to you at all. This is more marketing. It's not really. But there are other products like gummies and stuff like that that people use and have taken. You guys know I'm a big advocate for cannabis freedom. I think making something illegal that comes from a plant is bullshit. The bigger thing, though, is there are thousands of businesses in the state of Texas right now that operate in this window. Everything from people that make basically seltzers that instead of have alcohol in them, have a small amount of THC derived as per the Farm Bill, right? So totally legal under federal law. And some of them are like just people that sell it, like our local liquor stores sell that as an alternative now. There's tons of little shops that sell edibles, oils, all of the stuff that you know about. The big thing is there isn't a problem. There isn't a problem. I mean, that's the thing. Like, all of this shit that Patrick and the Texas GOP is talking about, and some of the Democrats, right? Remember, there's some Democrats in Texas that are more Republican than Republicans from the Northeast. I'll tell you that, right? So some of them kind of, they got enough coalition together, they got this thing passed. I think they all really thought that Greg would sign it. I think they really tried to kind of force it into other legislation. The thing is, Texas has line item vetoes anyway. The bill was garbage. It would have done tremendous economic harm to the state of Texas and tremendous harm to liberty in the state of Texas. And we already have enough restriction on liberty in the state of Texas. So Abbott vetoed it. And I'll tell you what, he might. Somebody says Greg smokes. He might. It really does set back that entire movement enough that it'll probably never happen now. Everybody's worried that in 2026, if Abbott doesn't run for re-election, which is pretty common for governors in Texas to serve a couple terms and go off and do something else. There's no term limits here, but it's generally speaking two terms and done. Something else is off. You're off to do something else. And Texas governor is a high enough position that generally it opens opportunities to go do other things at higher levels, like, you know, become a secretary of a department you want to get rid of, like Rick Perry did. There's a reasonable expectation he might not run for re-election, and that Patrick may run, and if he ran right now, he probably would win, and then you'll be able to get it done then. You're pushing off years now, and you have to remember the Texas legislature only comes into session once every 2 years. So this is like there is in the time that's left, they're not going to redo this bill and put it back in front of Abbott. So then they would have to get it done again, which after this happened, and you're going to see that the people of Texas are going to be very much in support of this. I've actually never seen anything with legitimate pushback by a politician's own party, which might be part of what he did. Again, people are giving me reports on Iran. Iran retaliated, sent missiles to a base in Qatar, no casualties. If that's true, which I can't verify right now, I don't have time to verify this in real time while we're live, then it's exactly what I said. And it would probably be the case that, like, literally somebody from the Iranian military got on the phone with somebody from the U.S. military and said, hey, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do about 2 hours from now. And we have to do the thing. And the guy on the American side going, I really wish you would do the thing, but I understand you have to do the thing. Click. And as long as everybody, kind of holds the line on their side of the agreement, that's probably how this is going to go forward. So, piss missile explosion, DOD says, Rick Perry's investing in a psychedelic mushroom clinic. I forgot the name. That is true, and I just shared some stuff on that on Facebook. I'm going to say something about politicians here, and I'm going to use my wife, who was never a politician, as an example, after I explain what I think about a lot of politicians, people like Rick Perry. I think Rick Perry was in some ways a good governor and in some ways a terrible governor. He completely sold out to the lobbyists for vaccines and drug makers. The bullshit he pulled with the vaccine for, I can't think of what the vaccine's called now, but it was run by Merck. Gardasil, the Gardasil vaccine was absolute garbage. Literally, his only executive order was to mandate that vaccine in the state of Texas, stated as, so the insurance companies have to pay for it. That's why I did it. His chief of staff, 2 weeks after he issued that EO, took a huge job working for the manufacturer of the Gardasil vaccine, making about $750,000 a year. So I have plenty of negative, and I covered all that as it happened years ago. So don't take this as like holding up Perry as a great guy. He happens to follow me on X for full disclosure. So I've actually had some direct communications with Perry at various times, limited, but just full disclosure. But now that he's not governor, nor a member of a president's cabinet, he's completely outside of politics. And all of a sudden, here goes old Rick digging into psychedelics, wanting to be involved with, like, he went to a big mushroom conference for psychedelics recently. How does that happen? Well, I'm going to tell you another story. So there's this woman named Dorothy. She's married to a guy named Jack, and this guy named Jack has always been very skeptical of conventional medicine for a variety of reasons, including the over-application of vaccines, especially on children. Now, everybody seems to have this opinion about me, which bears no resemblance to my statements or my reality, that I am anti-vax, as in no vaccines, vaccines are bad. I am not anti-vax. I do have a problem with giving a child who's a couple days old a hepatitis B vaccine, when the way you get that is through using intravenous drugs or having sex, and then trying to pawn it off with, but some children are born to drug-addicted prostitutes. Yeah, but I'm not one, and neither is my wife, so my baby doesn't need that. There's a whole gamut of places where I can point out that I'm not going to keep going. I'm just making the point that I had some real concerns about certain vaccines and vaccine frequency. And when I talked to my wife about this back in the day, right, this is like, from the beginning of TSP further back, while she was still working as a nurse in a pediatric clinic, it was like talking to a brick wall to try to get her to understand one thing about the risk associated with vaccines, which I only pushed so far because, one, don't piss off your wife when you don't have to if you want a recipe for happiness. I don't believe in the happy wife, happy life meme, because that's basically just be a simp and do whatever your wife tells you to. Take your balls off, put them in a coffee can, sit them on the refrigerator, and beg her when you're allowed to use them, right? I don't mean that. But you don't go out pissing off your wife if you're a smart man. You just don't. And you don't argue about things that even if she comes to an agreement with you, it's not going to actually change anything in the world. We didn't have any concerns about our son being overvaxxed or anything by that point. What was done. Just let it be. Today, if I am like on a scale of 1 to 10 and somebody believes just get every shot you're told whenever you're told, listen to the doctor, listen to the science, no questioning whatsoever is a 10. And the person who says 0, don't get any of them ever, be like the Amish, is a 1. If I'm a 7, my wife is a 4 on that spectrum. Why? Because she's not in the system anymore. And I believe this happens to politicians. like Rick Perry. I think this happens to a lot of politicians, and I actually believe sometimes they become our best advocates. And they become our best advocates because they know things that non-politicians don't know. And like when you are a governor of a state and you're on a cabinet position, you have privy to information that the average person is never going to see. You get an understanding for the inner workings, and you become seduced by it. And you realize to get anything done, I have to follow the system. And then when you get out of the system, you kind of have that yucky, icky, I need a shower feeling. And then you like reflect on it. And this is why I think we need term limits, by the way. I think we need like a master overriding term limit. Like so long in the House, so long in the Senate, so long as president. Okay, that's all great. But I think like high federal office, at least, there should be a total number of years a person can serve in that capacity, and then you get fuck out. And you can't be a lobbyist for, let's say, half a decade, 5 years after you get out. Like maybe you can if you're only in there for 4 or 5 years, but if you've been in government at high office, like House of Representatives, Senator, you know, cabinet positions and or president, but presidents never go into lobbying. So just leave the president out. But let's say for 20 years, you're very dangerous as a lobbyist, and it insulates you from living with the consequences of what you've done. So that's just an opinion that won't ever matter. Jim says term limits will never happen. Forget it. I didn't say they would happen. I said that's what I think. All right, let's move on. So the stablecoin bill is now law. It passed, as I said it would. And what I'm about to bring up on the screen for you right now is an article that's actually on, I think I went to the wrong one. Let's see. No, here it is. CNBC, but if you look up at the top, it's archived today. So CNBC has this behind a paywall. I'm not paying for it, CNBC. So I used archive.org to pull out the gist of the article. And basically, it's how the stablecoin bill gives Treasury Bessent a new tool to fund U.S. deficit. Now, I'm not going to read the thing to you. It's very long, and it's all jumbled together from the archive print of it. But you can read it if you want to. But this is the gist. It doesn't really have anything to do with Bessent directly. He's basically saying the same thing. So now the news is acting like they figured it out for themselves, which is what they always do. But I told you this, 4 or 5 weeks ago that this would happen. What Bessent is saying, look, if it's a bank and the bank wants to issue stablecoins, and by the way, they do, because if they didn't want to do it, we wouldn't have put the capital, the political capital, into getting the damn thing passed. Having to have Loomis go across the aisle and fight directly with people like Elizabeth Warren to get enough support to get this thing across the line. This actually took some horsepower to get done. So if the banks didn't want to do it, we wouldn't have done it. So the banks are going to do it. So now, how does a bank issue a stablecoin? I've already taught you this. It's very simple. They have to have a one-to-one ratio of liquid asset on the other side. So if they issue $1 billion, they have to hold $1 billion of something worth $1 billion that has enough liquidity to be liquidated on demand to fulfill any obligations created by that debt instrument, which is what a stablecoin is. It's a clone of the dollar, and the dollar is a debt instrument. Do you have to be able to cover the backside of it? There's only one really, really, really guaranteed way to do that. You can put up some Bitcoin reserves and say that's part of it, but it fluctuates, right? But a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. It doesn't matter if it goes up or down in value. It doesn't matter what inflation does to it. If I have to have a one-to-one banking and I have $1 billion here and $1 billion there backing it, I'm good. Okay, so what is the number one way that banks would make money on a stablecoin? Well, what they do is they issue the stablecoins to you in return for your money. They take your money and they buy a debt instrument that pays a fixed interest rate. And that interest asset is U.S. Treasury bonds. So remember how I told you and then I proved to you years ago that the reason they took all of the basic dollar funds and money market funds out of your 401k and replaced them with U.S. government bond funds was to force money into U.S. government bonds? And that was like 15 years ago that happened. And then everybody said no. And then everybody looked at it and said, yeah, they did it to me. I see what you're saying now, right? Okay. This is the same play, but it's bigger. The demand for U.S. debt bonds is about to go through the roof. It has to, because the banks are going to go all in on this. We're talking trillions of dollars. By buying bonds, it's going to convert bonds from high interest bonds with short terms on them, which is what we have. That's what we have right now. So you have very short term debt, and the interest rate keeps getting higher and higher to reissue that debt in the short term. And we have to reissue the debt in the short term, because if we don't, we run into problems. Yeah. Like not enough bonds being sold. Okay. Not enough treasury bonds being sold. And then the Fed has to step in as the buyer of last resort. That's like all kinds of red flashing to the market. Everybody goes friggin' ape shit like they did in 2008. Quantitative easing is coming, and puppy kittens rain from the sky, right? We don't want that. So we want to force buyers without forcing buyers. That's what the Genius Act was. It has other technical use cases that enable things like Bitcoin strategic reserves and other types of use cases that will be capitalized on to grow the economy. But the number one thing it does for government is it forces banks to buy more treasuries. Very simple. And it incentivizes people to give the banks more money to buy treasuries with. Because borrowing to loan, that we've kind of pushed that one to the edge. And what I mean is, like, the banks literally can go borrow money from the government and lend it back to the government at a higher rate than they borrowed it for. That's been going on forever, but that's a limited cycle. That eventually leads to the Federal Reserve being the buyer of last resort. So I'm not doing it. I'm not talking about your other than Bitcoin stories today. Sorry. All right. So that's going to happen. Everybody knows it now. Now everybody's acting like everybody always knew it. No, everybody didn't always know it. Remember, you heard it here for first. It's not so much "I told you so." It's, "Hey, don't forget that I told you so," because you need to be thinking about how to utilize this with your decisions economically going forward. This whole thing that the dollar is going to go to zero or whatever overnight, and you know you're going to be living on your 15 silver dimes that you stored away, and the grid's going to go down and Bitcoin won't work or whatever, it's not happening. It's not happening. There's going to be some really great economic opportunities in the next 10 years. Really hard shit too. Okay, there's a lot of flux, as I said it would be. We are in 2025. We're dead center of the 2020 to 2030 decade. We're exactly where I said we would be over 10 years ago, when I told you this would be the greatest decade of flux that any living person has ever seen. You're living in it. It doesn't feel so bad now, does it? Because you're actually seeing it instead of being afraid of it. But there's a lot to be afraid of. AI is going to take our jobs, right? Yeah, they took our jobs, right? Like, okay. Or you could learn how to use it, so you could use it in your job or what have you. But there's fear, but it should be mitigated right now. Let's move on. I want to talk about, this is one of those big paydays that I get every once in a while. And that's when I get an email that's totally unexpected, and it's positive, right? This is from a girl named Emma. And Emma says, "Hi, I just finished your book, as in today. It was recommended to me by my dad, who frequently listens to your podcast. To be completely honest, it took me a few days to get into it, but eventually I did. And then I finished it in a day and a half. I'm a young person. I just recently turned 17, to be exact. I have my big dreams to be successful, but I don't really know how I was going to accomplish it. When reading your book, with every new law, I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I recognized almost everything that would have stopped me from reaching my full potential was in fact there. And then I thought, I need to be doing this. Most of the writing was easy to understand. And when it wasn't so much, there was a real life story to help explain it better and in depth. That book is so marked up now, and I plan on reading it multiple times over and seeing what works and what doesn't and adjusting until it does. I don't think anyone would have told me these things other than my dad, but I think we find it hard to accept things our parents tell us. I am so grateful that I was introduced to this book so young rather than later. I can start now when I still have so much time to do all I can. You've gained a new student. Thank you, Emma." And I'll leave her last name out for privacy purposes. Holy crap. You couldn't give me a bigger gift, Emma. No one could. That's why I did it. I don't care if no one ever buys a copy of that book again. I don't care if every copy other than Emma's spontaneously bursts into flames. If that one person takes that and does something with it, it was worth the book. Thank you, Emma. And if you have somebody in your life that you'd like to make that impact on, consider using my book to do it in whatever form you want to do so. I am working on Laws of Life too. I think it'll be a better book. I've learned a lot from this first pass through. Remember, I'm a very experienced business person. I'm a pretty good blog writer, but blogs are short. This is the first attempt at a book that I've ever done. Thank you, Emma. Thank you so much. It made it worth it. Next, I'm going to talk more about mushrooms and compost and stuff like that later in the show. We're about to go into a Bitcoin segment for a little bit. But first, I just thought I wanted to show you guys this today. I did get a boom room from North Spore. They were very kind to send one. And I did a video yesterday of an update. So there's links in the show notes today. Once the live's over, you can go to the audio side and get the links that you can find both of the videos, the setup video, and then a video that I did on Sunday, yesterday morning. And one of the blocks had really started to fruit nicely, or pin is what we call it, a mushroom, where the little mushrooms are just sticking up. So this picture was taken about 10 a.m. yesterday morning that you're looking at right now. If you're in the audio, I would tell you the pins are about as, the biggest ones are about as big around as my little finger and about as long as the first joint of your little finger with a little cap on them. Some of them are much smaller. This is the thing, guys. This is what I woke up to this morning. Oh, wow. I mean, it's not a tripling. It's like a quadrupling or more in mass. And that happened in less than 24 hours. And I would tell you they're going to grow more today. And they're probably already headed to the point where you don't want to let them grow too much more. And so these will be harvested today, probably half of them cooked tonight, half of them tomorrow. This is amazing. Tom says I need a time-lapse camera. I may do that at some point. I think it'd be kind of cool to have like Shroom Cam, like just a little thing on the site where you can zoom in on Shroom Cam anytime you want, pointing at any particular block or maybe a group of blocks. I've also had lion's mane already start to pin. I've got about the size of a 50-cent piece little lion's mane head going now. I've got some golden oysters that are not in the video that are down on the bottom. That was a kit that I bought. It's just too dry in the house. Like the only thing that's really worked in the house this summer without special equipment has been pink oyster, which if you can't grow those, you can't grow anything. And Richard Hoffman says, boom! Yeah, that's why they call it the boom room, because it booms. I just also ordered a ton, I think like 6 blocks from Mushroom Mountain that are going to go in the North Spore Boom Room because I'm trying to give love to both companies. But, man, this is easy. This is like everything that you watch all these videos of all these people going through all kinds of hard shit to get their mushrooms to grow. Pick up something automated. They also make the Boomer Tubs. Those are awesome, and they're much more small scale and much more affordable. But this thing is still on just a great sale price. As of yesterday, it was. I didn't check today, so it might be worth checking. It's called the Boom Room 2. It's available at Norsemore.com. I want you guys to know I am working on a discount with them. Usually, though, a discount vendor, especially if they give you a good discount, let's say 15%, some in that neighborhood, they always make the code so if something's on sale, you can't stack it. Because they end up financially underwater that way. I'm betting right now they're selling this boom room at cost. When I just look at the price on it, or very close to it. Because once you have one, you're going to buy other stuff. So I think that's what they're... And once you get one of these, you're going to freaking do it. Right? You're going to freaking start doing more if you have a piece of equipment like this. Because it makes it so daggone easy. Anyway, I'm doing some things with the mushroom spent blocks now. That'll lead to some questions by Roy later on. Oh, it says on sale right now for $448.99. That's still a good price. It was less than that last week. It was like $389 or something like that. I would say even at that price, that's 10% off. If you want one, go ahead and do it. I'm working still with the guy that's going to be on the air with me next month to get this ironed out. I did have the person, like North Spore is pretty big. They have a pretty big team. The person who sent me the kit and the boom room sent me a link the other day and said, like, we're getting a lot of hits on this. Why don't you join our affiliate program and make some money off the referrals? And I'm not doing that. I need to actually answer their email. You guys know this. I protect my members, and it's not that I won't do anything with an affiliate deal, but if I'm dealing with a company that's even with a big team, like small enough to talk to actual key decision makers. Like I can't do this with, you know, Amazon or Vavor or whatever. But if it's something like a small business, everything I do is like, don't give me the affiliate. Give my members the discount. So that's what I'm trying to work on to do for you. With that, I want to talk about some Bitcoin topics for a bit here. Just some general stuff that keeps coming in. So like I said, last week, I think it was on Thursday, I had a segment on the Expert Counsel show where somebody wrote me an email and they said, I need like it broken down to five simple steps how to buy Bitcoin because I haven't bought any Bitcoin. And so I answered that question. At least I think that was the person who I was asking the question. It was the same person. But when I was going through my folder with stuff for shows like this today, I saw, I'm like, oh, I already answered this. And then I just actually used my good eye a little bit better and paid attention. And so I said, I do not want to take money from my bank or I don't want to use my bank account to do it. I have not heard back from this person. I really wish I had heard back. Let me check real quick. You know, if the email box isn't too crazy, doesn't look like I've heard back. Why? Like, what is your thought process there? So let me give you the short answer. You absolutely do not want to use your bank account for whatever reason. You do have a PayPal account. Unless it's a PayPal business account, you could just buy Bitcoin from PayPal. I think you could take custody from there. I'm not able to do it because my PayPal account's a business account. And you can't buy Bitcoin with a PayPal. I don't know why. Block and Square and things like that. But to me, those are just like pseudo bank accounts. If you had a PayPal account and you didn't have a personal one, you had a business one, you wanted to use the money in there, Coinbase charges too high a fees, but it's not so exorbitant that I would say not to do it at all. And again, you can save money at Coinbase just by switching to advanced mode. You can use PayPal to buy Bitcoin at Coinbase. Okay, you can deposit money from PayPal. So you could do that. It's still bank account-ish to me, right? You can have a service like Strike. You can have a direct deposit if you have a payroll run. Now, this guy said he wanted to do it from his side hustle. But if you're running a payroll for yourself, that's just, you can set that up too. And you can have a direct deposit into like River or Strike and buy it that way. And then it never touched your bank account, but it's still KYC. I think what this person really means is I want to buy Bitcoin with no KYC, no know your customer requirements. I want to buy it anonymously. Okay, so there are some ways to do it. And if you want to pay 25% or more over the asking price, that's how you can do it. I'm not going to tell you to do it because I think it's a really dumb thing to do. I don't know why you feel that you need to do this. Someone here had some bullshit about using Monero for these purposes and whatever. But you still have to get somebody to give you the Bitcoin, right? And you still have to get the Monero. So if you really want Bitcoin with no KYC and you have a side hustle, then what you want to do is sell your product for Bitcoin. And you know what? That Bitcoin was KYC'd when they bought it, and it's traceable to you. Like this whole idea that, like, I don't know what if people think they're Jason Bourne or some shit. You watch too many friggin' movies from 15 years ago when all the bad guys were using Bitcoin on a little thing hanging on their neck and it made them rich or whatever. But there is no reason for this paranoia. The whole purpose of Bitcoin is so you can't take it from me. Okay? And if you're going to try to use Bitcoin for tax fraud, you're going to go to the federal penitentiary. So don't do that. Okay? What I think you should do is just buy your Bitcoin. And if you are going to have some no KYC Bitcoin, that's great. Have its own bucket. Use a different wallet or a different set of UTXOs if you use a node and you manage your own. And then remember this. And I don't care if you're using super duper extra caliber analytic Monero times 75.3 privacy factor 9. Okay. I don't care what anybody spins up. I don't care how hard it is. Okay. I don't care how hard it is that you have tried to use the most encrypted cryptocurrency on the cryptation encryption ever. I don't care if it's so well encrypted that the NSA and the CIA combined with special characters from TV that don't really exist that hack everything can't hack it. Unless you and your counterparty are both using full security protocols, VPNs, firewalls, etc. And even then, if you're targeted, they're still going to get you. But without that, you don't have any protection at all. If there's any communication that's unencrypted from one end to the other about the transaction, then the transaction can be figured out. Okay? So I don't know where this idea is that I'm going to have super secret money, but it ain't going to happen. And I don't believe in investing in an asset that is freely available. I mean, you could just buy it. Okay? And then trying to hide the fact that you bought it makes any sense. Because remember, the only time we ever pay tax on Bitcoin anyway is when we liquidate it. And the model right now should be stacking forever and borrowing against in the future anyway, unless you have to sell. And then you have to pay taxes, just like you do on any money you earn. And I have some other thoughts on this that I'll save for later. Another big announcement, though. Texas is now the first state in the United States of America that officially has law passed, system in place, Bitcoin reserve. And it will be purchased with public money under the new law. So this got passed. Abbott signed this one into law. And I think this was as good a decision to sign into law as the cannabis to veto was a good decision to veto. This was a great bill. It's good for Texas and states that do this. As we get into positions in the future where it's more important for states to assert state sovereignty, are economically going to be in a better position to do so. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Jack, the federal constitution says that the states cannot make a thing money unless it's silver or gold. Well, if they wanted to have TX bucks, sure. But it doesn't mean they can't spend it. It doesn't mean they can't borrow against it. It doesn't mean they can't leverage it. And it doesn't mean they can't use it as a hedge against inflation. And it doesn't mean that they can't do a state chartered bank where it plays some role. It just means they can't say it's money, but they can call it what it is. Bitcoin. This is going to be freaking awesome. And the biggest reason isn't because, yay, I'm from Texas. I would be cheering this if I was from Florida and just wondering what Ron, why? You always do the thing. And then Greg does the thing 6 months later. Why didn't you go first? That's all I'd be saying to Florida. But I, you know what else I would be saying? Good, because when a state like Texas or Florida or sadly California does a thing, it has a lot of impact on what other states in the union do. Texas is the first. It will not be the last. There will be at least enough to get rid of all five fingers on one hand by the end of this year. So we have four left. Four more will fall. By the end of 2025, when we go into 2026, we'll either have five minimum states with this in place or at least five that have passed the legislation, even if the system's not actually in place yet. You can mark that down that Jack Spirko said that's going to happen. There's a whole bunch of them that were like this close on the edge, and there's a bunch that failed that now may take another run at it because now they can point to an example. There's also some states that are going to go, well, somebody else did it. Why don't we sit back and see how it works out for them? And this is what will likely happen. We probably will have a retraction in price going into sometime in next year in that part of the cycle. I don't think it'll be as dramatic as it was in the past. And all the morons on TV will go, Texas is going bankrupt because of this, with no idea about the underlying numbers at all. And if Texas is smart, when that retraction comes, they'll buy more and more. And every time it goes down, buy more. That's what they'll do. We'll see if that's what they do. That's what I expect them to do. Fred just said, I just joined a few minutes ago. Did Jack say you shouldn't buy Bitcoin with Strike with your bank account? He did not say that. I did not say that at all. I was telling someone who wanted to not use their bank account how they could use Strike without using their bank account by using a direct deposit into there. So just to answer that one, I don't want anybody confused. Let's move on. Because, you know, Bitcoin's never confusing or anything. I got this really interesting email, and what it said was, if Bitcoin was $1 million right now, with the amount I have, I could retire for the rest of my life and live well. But that would be basically a 10x from where we are. And if inflation, if Bitcoin 10x's, that means inflation 10x, and the value of the dollar went down 10x, then I basically have the same money. And I can't retire on what I have if gas is $30 a gallon. Okay, even with the Strait of Hormuz being closed off by the Iranians, we're not going to have $30 a gallon gas. In fact, any gas fluctuations, going back to that first segment, that you do have will be mostly bullshit anyway. It'll be market reactionary forces and futures traders capitalizing on the news. There won't be any significant supply crunch in the next 2 months, period, no matter what happens, because that's not how supply chains work when you have to refine oil into gasoline. Just saying. But we're not going to have $30 a gallon gas anytime soon, and there's a false belief here. And so the belief this person has is that Bitcoin isn't just an inflation hedge. It has a direct sort of relationship to inflation. But the reason it's worth so much is because the dollar's worth so little, which is true if you go back historically, but Bitcoin's been around at least as a concept and some code since 2008. The current form of the United States dollar has been around in exactly this form since 1971, but it began its true decline in value in 1913. So there's a long run-up for just that inflationary component to adjust itself. But that doesn't really make sense either in totality. In other words, it's still not enough. So if we just look at the last 5 years, how much has Bitcoin gone up in value in the last 5 years? Somebody can go look up the exact figure, but it's somewhere over 1,400%. 1,400% in 5 years, not since inception. Like that number's so ridiculous, I don't want to use it because it starts out with Bitcoin below a penny when you couldn't buy it anyway. All you could do is mine it. But 5 years is a good number, 1,400%. Inflation has not gone up 1,400% in the last 5 years. If it did, most of you would have jumped off a building by now. So it's not a direct correlation. So Bitcoin moving from 100,000 to a million does not equal a 10x devaluation of the dollar in any way except against Bitcoin's purchasing power, which is why you would invest in the first place. So the correlation just isn't there the way it's implied. Now, if the dollar collapsed overnight, is it possible that basically $100,000 worth of Bitcoin a day would buy what $100,000 would the day before, even if the number on Bitcoin was, you know, $10 million? Sure, that's an overnight currency collapse. And then you'd still be better off, even if you're not retiring. Because what's your other option? Hold all dollar-denominated securities and assets? You see what I mean? Like, it's just, no, not going to happen. Don't worry about it. It is appropriate to estimate the value of Bitcoin based on the pricing model relative to inflation's models. That is a thing you can and should do, especially as part of your retirement and your long-term investing programs. You should think about that. Like, if Bitcoin goes up 5x, but inflation takes away like 2x of it, and I'm only left with 3x over inflation, and that's how you should manage all your money. I bought this ETF and it went up this much. Yeah, but what did inflation do during that time? That's the part you keep, right? It's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. There's more than one way to run that formula. All right, next though, I had a question from somebody, and I think I have this one over here where I can look at it. No, I don't. I do not have it. I don't. No, don't. All right. So basically, summary of the question is, if I have Bitcoin, like in a wallet, and I have an exchange account where I buy Bitcoin, and I do what you say, and once I get up to like, you know, $1,000 in the exchange account, I move it to my self-custody. And then once I get to a certain amount there, I move it to a hardware wallet. And that's what I'm doing now. But I also have, let's say, a 401k at work, and I have an option in it where I could be buying, you know, Bitcoin ETF. Should I do that or should I keep buying from the exchange? My answer to that or question is one of those times where somebody says, should I do A or B? And I go, yes. And you go, but I asked or, and I just answered you. And I said, yes. Now exactly how you take that is up to you and your individual investment planning and goals, your risk tolerance, the point you're at now, how far you are from early retirement, need to be retired age, all of those things. I am not an investment manager. I am not a financial advisor. I talk about the macro and let you make your own decision. But I would say that I look at it this way. There's a lot of people that have a fuckload of money in 401ks, IRAs, et cetera, that now have access to Bitcoin with that money without liquidating the account and paying taxes and penalties on it. And you get to have the appreciation of the value of that Bitcoin without a tax consequence to it. Now, I know what somebody's going to say, but Jack, you have this plan that in the future we'll be able to borrow against our Bitcoin and do it in perpetuity like rich people do with real estate today. Doesn't that mess it up? Well, no, because you could liquidate it and move it into hard Bitcoin that you could post as a collateral at some point if you needed to without the tax consequence. But then you do 59 and a half to start taking distributions, et cetera. And there is a point where they'll force you out of it, but you're going to sell at market value. And if you just wanted Bitcoin now outside, it'd be no different than cash. You take the cash out of your thing. You have a mandatory withdrawal amount for that year. And I don't want to spend the cash, but you would just move it outside of that envelope, and you would just put it in cash in a bank somewhere else, in a laddered CD, whatever you wanted to do to obtain a yield. Well, you could do the same thing with Bitcoin. Now, you would liquidate the BlackRock ETF for cash. You would take the cash out, and then you would buy Bitcoin on the outside to do whatever you wanted to do if you wanted it back in that form. So there's, like, no reason not to do this. You have money that is held captive. I never recommend taxes and penalties on your retirement account money unless it's some sort of absolute emergency and you have to do it. And I always recommend, if it's a Roth, and it should be, taking the money out of the Roth that you put in before you touch any of the interest and gains, because you can do that interest and penalty free. You just fill the form out, right? But there's still a lot of people that can't, right? And Jason's saying right now, because people are doing the fucking gold and silver shit again, which it's a different asset class. It has a different purpose. And he says, I travel too much for gold and silver. Bitcoin functions better for me. Yeah, it doesn't matter that you travel, bro. Go try to spend silver tomorrow anywhere. Good luck. Okay? It's a different asset that does a different thing. Bitcoin has the saleability across space and time that gold and silver will never have. Now, if you want to bank in gold, right, you can actually buy Tether gold, and you can pay with Tether gold in a conversion to dollars, and you can bank with gold if you want to that way now. By the way, just saying. I wouldn't do it, right? I wouldn't do it. But this whole idea that, like, every single person, I'll get to this in a minute because I got one more bullet point if we leave Bitcoin, but every single person, I believe in gold and silver, not Bitcoin because I can touch it. They don't have any, or they have like $50 worth or $1,000 worth that they really can't do much with, right? I'm sorry. I don't want to hear your shit. Every person that's ever made that argument to me, when I really drill down with them, I have more freaking silver than they do. Okay? And I have a lot more wealth in Bitcoin because it's a better allocation of your funding than I do in silver. Okay? Just saying. The travel means nothing, Jason. I don't care if you never leave your house. Good luck spending silver. Good luck. But my view is, if I have a lot of money and I'm not happy with the allocation of it and I have something else I could allocate it to inside that vehicle, I don't care that it's a Bitcoin ETF. It could be buying MicroStrategy or Strategy B or whatever. It could be a completely different thing. It could be a different investment segment. Now, I am going to factor in, how much Bitcoin do I have outside? Like, what percentage of my long-term investments do I want in Bitcoin? And then I want to balance that. But if I'm under that number and I've got it inside, and I might slowly move it over and DCA it in. In fact, that's what I would do. Right. Now, if anybody thinks that when I say this, I'm telling you to do this because it's what I do. I don't have a 401k because I'm self-employed. I do have IRAs. Whatever needed to be done with them has already been done. I am not actively buying ETFs inside of my retirement accounts right now with Bitcoin ETFs because the balance is where I want it to be. But if I was like, man, I need to have, for my goals to be met, guaranteed on the Bitcoin side, another Bitcoin right now, I'd go into one of those accounts and I would do it. I would go, and that's exactly, so it's about how much do you have and where, you know, and what are your long-term goals and how old are you and everything else, all right? Now, I just wanted one more thing on Bitcoin before I go on. And it doesn't matter if it's I believe in silver and gold, or what about when the grid goes down, or what about when they ban it, or what about when somebody flips a switch? Or what about quantum computing? Every one of those objections, I answer the same way. I just have to very butthurt people on Billy Bond's show. I went on there to talk about my book. I didn't want to talk about Bitcoin. He did, right? And they did. I wanted to talk about my book. He also asked me about my opinion about Iran and what was going to happen. And I pretty much said it was going to happen, and it did. It's kind of interesting. I didn't want to talk about that either. I wanted to talk about my freaking book. But no, they won't. So I'll answer what you asked me. Now, you guys know my tone. You know my voice. You know the way I am. You know I'm animated. And you know when I know something, then I'm emphatic about the way I explain it. Well, I answered every question the same way on that show. And then the Bitcoin thing came up with, well, what good is it when the grid goes down? And I answered it the same way I answered every other question. Well, this particular small group, it's like four people in the comments all ganging up together, were deeply offended by it because I was insulting and putting down and mocking the person that made the objections. Now, what I actually said was, I've seen this person in the comments. She's asked many really smart questions, so I know she's a smart question, and I'm not putting her down or attacking her. And I said that before I said anything else. And then I answered it the way I always do. And then, oh my God, I don't want to ever hear you again. Just crybaby shit, whatever. We all have crybabies. In my audience, I've got some. Billy's got some in his audience, whatever. And I also think one of the people really crying thought I was answering her question or his question because they asked it too, apparently. It wasn't even the person, because I see the comments coming in a StreamYard. Billy uses the same system I do. It was a totally different person who had asked, I guess, a similar or the same question. But what I said is, what good is your bank account if there's a nuclear bomb dropped on you tomorrow? Well, that's mocking. That's not mocking. It's making a point. Every single asset we hold has a corresponding risk to it. And the risk of the grid going down and never coming back is so beyond stupid, as though humans would never. And if that happens, the last thing you're going to be thinking is, damn, I wish I would have had less of my money in Bitcoin and more of it in U.S. dollar funds in the bank, right? That's going to be your last thing you're going to think about, right? I wish I had more silver. You should have silver and or gold. But if the grid's down, it ain't going to do you that much good either. Beans, bullets, and Band-Aids, baby. We know that. And this is always temporary condition throughout history. Like, unless we do have, like, a extinction-level event, but some remnant survives and you happen to be among them, again, that's not you're the last thing you'll be thinking is, man, I wish I had less Bitcoin. But I think it's very possible that 10, 15, 20 years from now, you're going to be sitting there going, gee, I wish I had more Bitcoin. I think that is way more likely than the alternative. And any of these fill in the blank, what they are is they're silver bullet excuses, not reasons, excuses. And this is where I believe that it comes from. People like me have been telling you about this for about 15 years. We've been telling you very, very emphatically for 10. Everything we've said has happened and you didn't do it. And now you're angry. You're mad. You're bitter because you think you missed the opportunity. And I don't know how many times I have told people this. I would love an estimated count from anybody on live feed. How many times has Jack Spirico said you didn't miss the opportunity, you're missing the opportunity in the past 10 years? And my guess is it's in the hundreds. It's in the hundreds. And it's still the case. You're still missing the opportunity. Is it the same opportunity that you had when Bitcoin was $600 when I got in earnest? No. It's not the same ROI based. It's the same opportunity, but it's not the same potential ROI as quickly. But it wasn't as quick as all of you dummards think it was. Right? It wasn't. There was a lot of pain. There was a lot of pain in those years. There was a lot of woohoo, oh no, woohoo, oh no, right? Volatility, that's what you cry about. We had to ride through it. We did. It benefited us, and now you're bitter that you didn't take the ride too. And most of you that are still out, if you did get in, would have bailed out along the way and said something dumb like, it went down, so I had to sell it. And when I said something like, well, did you need a kidney transplant? Did your car blow up? Like, did you just have to have the money at a time that was in or opportune to sell? Okay, but no, it's usually somebody that bought $1,500 worth and it went down to $800 worth and the rationale was, but it was going to go to zero. So you wouldn't have anyway. Your choice now. It's your choice now to participate in this. The difference is when we were putting money into this shit 10, 15 years ago, there was no guarantees. And not only were there no guarantees, there were a lot of risks. Some of the they're going to ban it. I would say back then that was still for a while a possibility. It will just fail. Sure, that was a possibility. It's going to get hacked. I never really thought it was a possibility, but then the realist in me said, well, you know, it's only so proven so far. And like, will the blockchain mining grow sufficiently to protect it as it becomes more? The answer to all that is yes. We now have sovereign entities, nations and states holding Bitcoin. We have the largest financial company in the world in BlackRock with an ETF. We have laws being passed to protect Bitcoin ownership. We have banks adopting it. We have major corporations adopting it. We have entire business models being launched based on Bitcoin as an asset to leverage debt against as collateral. In other words, the opportunity is as good as it ever was, and the risk is less. It is now an asymmetric thing, unless you need the money next month or even next year. There is no way yet that we can say with an accurate prediction that this thing won't lose value between today and 12 months from now. Now, I personally think we're going to see a lot more up before a retraction. I think the retraction will be muted. I've called the last two retractions within 3% of the bottom. And every time we hit the bottom, whether I was right or wrong, I said, this is the bottom, and it was. So I have a pretty good track record here. It does not make me Spiro Dahmus. It really doesn't. But it does say that I'm probably more accurate than the clown on TV telling you it's a pet rock or whatever. Right? It's up to you. But this idea, quantum computing, that's like this is what I see in all these people. Well, you should do this because list of reasons, well thought out, logical, planned reasons here with complete understanding and facts behind them. And they go, nah, 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 nah. Stick your fingers in their ear. And instead of saying, nah, 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 they say, quantum computing, grid go down, light switch, right? It's they want something to make it go away. You want me to tell you how I would have respect for a person when it comes to Bitcoin? Not, I just don't understand it, because that's willful ignorance. You've chosen not to understand it. Not quantum computing. Not grid go down. Not flip switch, right? No, no, no. I don't want to. Fine. I don't have another freaking thing to say except HFSP. I mean, you're free to make that choice, but don't give me, because this is the problem. And this is something you have to understand when you ask someone like me this question. And when I say someone like me, I don't just mean me. I mean anybody in this space that's like a podcast or personality, whatever, this question. When you say that, what you're trying to do is shut down what I'm telling everybody else that wants to hear it. You're also looking for some level of my acknowledgement that you're right, some sort of implied endorsement. Well, yeah, you know, I can see why you would have that. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that any more than if you emailed me today and said, Jack, I think that we're going to have World War III, and I want to take all my money out of my retirement account right now. Damn the penalties, and I want to buy bean bullets and Band-Aids and a bunker in Montana and go hide in a hole in the ground. I wouldn't say okay to that. Your two statements are willfully ignorant equally. One's more fear-driven, and one's more risk-adverse-driven, but it's the same phenomenon. And the reason I call it willful ignorance is we do not live in 2012 anymore, where it's hard to find this information. If you wanted to understand how Bitcoin really worked, how the network is secured, how changes are managed and made, if you wanted to become a reasonable person that could at least talk like an expert about Bitcoin, it would take you 2 days. 2 days of intense study and review and basic and developing a plan. I need to be able to answer these 20 questions astutely. And you've chosen not to, but you've chosen to listen to people who say the things you want to hear. That is willful. It's by the very definition of the word. And this is why I don't have patience for these people anymore. I don't, period, because it is not my place at this point in my life to hold your hand and make you feel good about your bad decision, okay? Or even your not optimal decision. I'm not going to say it's bad. If you're like 70 years old and you have your retirement plan in front of you and you're like, I cannot possibly outlive the income that I need for the rest of my life, I don't want to do this because it's different and strange and I don't care, I don't fault you for it. But if you're still in your working years and you're laying up capital for your future denominated in something that is designed to lose value, I'm not going to tell you that's a good idea. I'm sorry. It's not. It's a terrible idea. You shouldn't do that. And if it's not Bitcoin, you should have a plan that's better than I believe in gold. especially because most, again, one more time, and I'm going to go on to just some totally different shit. Most of the people that say that don't have any of any significant amount. They live in a fantasy world where they read a book by James Rawls or something, and they think their 1 ounce of gold and 50 ounces of silver is going to make them a millionaire someday in real terms. It won't. It won't. It will not. Moving on. All right, so I got a comment on my video about the Boom Room from Roy, Colonel Roy, really good guy. Many of you have met him. And he was asking me a couple things. And the first one he asked was, so he asked two different comments. So the first comment was, basically I said, when I use a fruiting block, which is what you saw that picture of, right? This is a fruiting block right here for those that maybe missed that earlier. It's basically a compacted block of sawdust. Sometimes there's other materials in it. I make some of my own using a mix of hardwood pellets and coffee. Sometimes it's there's grain spawn in them, whatever. But fruiting blocks are almost always mostly sawdust. And by a fruiting block, it means that you don't have to do anything. You don't have to mix it. You don't have to put it in a bucket. You can basically take that block, put it in the right conditions, temperature, humidity, light, etc., and it will do just like that one on your screen. It will fruit. Well, many of these fruiting blocks, that's called a flush. And the one you were looking at there a couple seconds ago is a first flush. Well, some will do a second flush, a third flush, some even a fourth flush before they kind of peter out. And even if you get anything, it's like little bits, little pins here. It doesn't really do much anymore. When I have one that reaches that state, I pick this up from the folks at North Spore. I take the whole block, I go out to my garden, I pick a spot, I dig a hole, and I drop the block in the hole, and I cover it up. I try to pick a spot that has good shade, especially in the evening, either because of the way the garden's laid out, so like a building shades it, or like there's a big plant there, and it's under the shade of that plant for at least part of the day. And I always try to pick a spot where one of the emitters in my drip system is right there, and it's going to get watered like it was a plant. What this results in is every once in a while you walk out there and go, look at that big old pink clump of oyster mushrooms. It's pink oysters, right? Or Italian oysters or a lion's mane bulbing out of your – it's like bonus harvest from your garden. And at the same time, you're increasing the fertility in the garden. You're increasing the biodiversity, et cetera, and that's the way I do it. Well, I had also said in the past, and I bet Roy – because Roy listens, right? Roy probably heard this. You know, another way that you can do this, you can just buy fruiting blocks and just plant them in your garden. And that also came from North Spore. So they're not spent. They're brand new. They're fully charged. They're ready to go. These, if you put them in the right condition at the right time of year, usually fruit really fast, like within a week. And you get a really good response, especially oysters. Oysters are great for this, a whole variety of them. And I said, well, if you're going to do that, you could literally take that block and cut it into four chunks and bury it in four different spots and get more spread out flushes. So he said, well, can you do that with a spent block? I don't, and I wouldn't. And the reason that I wouldn't, and Kevin, no, I have not used agar to germinate spores. I'm very low tech. I don't even get sterile. I get sanitized, right? I treat it like brewing beer. Anyway, I said I wouldn't do it because that block has used a lot of energy now. It's done three or four flushes. So by leaving it together, you're probably going to get at least one or two good flushes out of it. One maybe fairly clipped a couple months, and then one maybe like next year or something, right? I ran that by AI, and AI said your reasoning is solid, that's what to do. So that's the first question. But he also said, on another note, what is your experience using spent material in your garden? Do you mix it with other compost or leave it in a compost pile before using? We've used spent compost in my dad's big garden, and the plants grew like gangbusters, but most of the plants, like tomatoes and peppers, didn't fruit all the way or very little, but they did better a year or two later. I speculated the nitrogen level in the spent blocks was so high that it caused massive growth but didn't have enough P and K to balance out for fruiting, hence why it did better in subsequent years because of using leaching N. What do you think about that? Thanks, Roy. I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because mushroom spawn is just not that high in nitrogen. It just isn't. That's why. Like, unless you use, like, two truckloads of it in one garden, there's just probably not enough there, okay? My gut is more that you were actually deficient in P and K, not unbalanced by it, and that led to a lack of fruiting. And there's a whole host of other reasons. that that could have happened. Let's say that, because I don't know how much Roy got, let's say that maybe he went by somebody's, you know, mushroom farm. And there's a lot of professional growers. One flush and done. That block has a lot left in it, but they have a system set up to maximize production per square foot. And that means, unless it's a really reliable second flusher, they get rid of it. That means there's a lot of carbon left to be consumed in there. If you get that and you get enough of it, it's not a nitrogen issue you might have. It might be putting too much carbon in that you created. So, like, if you were to just go out and get an absolute fuck ton of sawdust and put it into your soil, you could get a lot of micro bind up and a lot of kind of nitrogen capture and hold. Now, exactly what you said would happen, eventually it would give it back and you'd have great years down the road. Kind of like using biochar naked. That's also, I ran this all by AI, and AI said, I think you're right. That long shot you just described is a better long shot than Roy's long shot. So the reality is, without knowing everything you did, Roy, I can't tell you if that was the case. You could have had a calcium deficiency for all we know, right? You could have had an unbalanced biological position where something was bound up, even if it was there, like a calcium bind up. You could add a magnesium deficiency, and the magnesium deficiency created a calcium deficiency, even if the calcium was there. But this whole thing where, like, when you give nightshades, specifically high-feeding nightshades like peppers and tomatoes, too much nitrogen, they don't produce. It can happen. I've seen it happen. One place that I saw it happen at a commercial level was a pepper farm in New Mexico. And it turned out the man had spread 14 inches depth of worm castings. That's the only verifiable time I've really seen it happen at any kind of scale. And he did end up with pepper plants that were like 5 foot freaking tall with barely any production. And I bet you it turned into a hell of a, if he didn't lose it over that one season, I bet you it turned into a hell of a place in time. But it can be done, but it is not likely. It's not likely. The balance part that Roy is asking about, though, is possible. Personally, I don't spread it out, mix it in, whatever. If I'm doing something like that, it would be more likely I'm taking a wheelbarrow full of wood chips and a block or two of King Strophoria spawn and inoculating those wet wood chips and then spreading them as mulch. And that would be new spawn, not old spawn. So it all depends on volume, bro. So let me know, you know, how to get in touch with me, the more details, and I can kind of ferret out what I think might have happened. But it's probably one of those things, since you didn't test for anything at the time and it happened back in the past, there's probably no way to know. Everything will be speculation and hypothesis. I also got an email from a guy that said he was mixing his own mulch, basically rabbit manure and wood chips. Let me pull that up over here for you so I get the ratio right. But this was another one that I did run by AI, and AI agreed with my take on it. I'm just here it is. Mixed fertilizer from Zach. Would you recommend a mixture of aged wood chips, biochar, and rabbit manure? I would, Zach. I think it's a very good mix of stuff. He said, I've got several cubic yards of wood chips that have been aging for 18 months. Okay, first of all, congratulations. You did something most people won't do with wood chips, which is, in Matt Power's words, be patient. Pile them up and leave them there for a while. They don't have to turn into compost. Just let biology get involved, right? That's beautiful. I have a super sack of biochar that I bought for $250. I didn't make it. And can fill several five-gallon buckets of rabbit manure from under my rabbit cages. My thought was 80% wood chips, 15% rabbit manure, and 5% biochar. Just looking for some input, or am I overthinking here? That's roughly a mixture I use in my raised vegetable garden, but now I'm going to fill in low spots and holes around the yard. I know it'll settle. I'm just doing it. I'll be doing it again in a year or two when they start to annoy me again. I don't know if you – okay. Your ratio is beautiful, and treat it like mulch, not soil. It's not broken down. It's going to compost in place slowly. Excellent long-term nutrient release. That mix, personally, I would mix it and let it go for a week or two before I added it to a productive system like a garden, just so the biochar has time to become inhabited and to become inoculated before it goes in the garden. I think that would be a best practice. It doesn't need to be compost or anything. Just it don't need to dry out, right? You don't want it bone dry, and just give it a week before you apply it, and it should be wonderful. I actually would have a hard time coming up with a better organic fertilizer slash mulch than that right there, because the rabbit manure is a cool manure. It can go straight on the garden anyway. It does not need to be composted, and those wood chips will act as a great mulch. The biochar will hold everything over time. Critters will incorporate it into your soil without disturbing it. It's beautiful. The only reason I would recommend using it in your low spots is it's like driving a Ferrari down a creek bed. It'll do it, but is that how you want to treat your Ferrari? You know what I mean? Like, it's a low spot in a yard. Now, if it's a problem low spot, in that it's not just that it's a low spot, it's like nothing grows there and that's why it's a low spot, but, you know, you might want to overseed it a little bit. Like, maybe you won't be doing it next year, and maybe that makes sense. It's almost that it's too good for the application. But there's nothing wrong with it, and the ratios are perfect. If you would have asked me what ratio to use, I mean, really, 80-15-5? That's probably what I would have gave you. That's gold, bro. And I would tell you, if you have surplus, I'd be selling it to neighbors before I was using it. You could use sand for a low spot, right? I mean, because it fills in nice and all. But if you have plenty of it, it's not that many low spots, go ahead. It's just, again, you're driving your Ferrari down a creek bed. It'll do it, but that's, you know, your Ferrari belongs doing 200 miles an hour on a track somewhere. That's where it really belongs. But so there you go on that one. That's a beautiful mix, though, and I bet your garden results are going to be amazing. The last one was, how do you get rid of sand spurs on your property without chemicals? And anybody that's had sand spurs in their toes knows they hurt, right? I mean, it's always was one of the worst things when we were kids growing up in Florida. Those things were everywhere, and everybody wore flip-flops, right? And you get one, like, in the side of your toe, and it hurts when it goes in, but, it, like, you got to pull it out. That hurts because, like, you're, like, trying to get a leaf or something so it doesn't go in your other fingers. But when you pull it out of your toe, like, that really hurts, right? Out is worse than in. And so they suck, and they get in everything. They get in dog's paws, and you have to pull them out of the dog's paw. And, you know, the dog is not happy, like, you know, the fact that my pit bull used to let me pull them out for him without biting me, I always would tell him, thank you, buddy, thank you. And he'd come, be like, please, man, get this off me. And we had him bad here. So bad that my buddy's service dog just would be like, and like, you'd go get him and pick him up so he didn't have to walk in it. We had people that would camp here during workshops. Again, 6 months later, posting a picture like, does anybody still have these bastards stuck in their gear? And it would be from Jack Spirko's place, right? So my point is they were bad. And there was a specific, and this is usually the case, it's not there everywhere. There might be a few here and there, but there'll be patches where there's a significant portion of them. And it'll be about, you know, between now and August when all of a sudden there's millions of them all with thorns on and ready to get you. And it's usually at the dry time of the year because they actually thrive in dry climates. Some reason they call them sand spurs is because they like sandy, well-drained soils. They don't like to be too wet. And I mean wet, that grass is like, woohoo, baby, this is perfect. They don't like that. So that's one of their biological weaknesses. So I'm going to tell you the basic thing you can do. Make some fertilizer like we were just asked about from Zach, or make some really good compost and spray it and spray it. Pretend you're trying to make them grow better, because they won't. They don't like fertility. They don't like high biology. They like stressed environments. They're a pioneer. And you'll notice that almost all pioneer vegetative species are prickly and spiky and spiny. And that's either because they have to defend themselves, because many pioneer species are delicious to eat, if not for you, for animals, right? Or because they like shitty places. Once they colonize a shitty place, they're kind of out of ways to spread, because they don't spread in, like, sand spurs will not spread into the high fertility part of your land. They just won't do it. Maybe one or two, but really overall they don't. So they need a way to get to the other shitty parts by being a spur, a sticker, a burr, anything that gets on animal hair or human clothing. Then you walk by, you pick one up, and you kick it off somewhere else. And it, hopefully, if it does that enough, it will propagate itself to other shitty areas that it can pioneer. So that's how they function. Now that we know how they function and what they like and what they don't like, all we need to know is what their reproductive cycle is. Here's the good news. None of them are perennials. There are no sand spurs that are perennials. Jack, you're wrong because they're in the same place every year. I didn't say they didn't come back. I said none of them are perennial, meaning none of them grow, hit the end of a life cycle, and then regrow from the same root. They are a self-receding annual. Now, in some climates where it doesn't get cold enough for them to die in a frost, you can have new plants growing throughout the year and they become very perennial-like in performance, but that plant has a life expectancy, it will reach the end of its life, and it will die. Now we have the formula for their elimination. They don't like fertility, they don't like moisture, and they're an annual that must recede to propagate itself. Simple now. We increase the fertility. We irrigate the location. Now, if you have these on 40 acres, you can't irrigate. Everything else will still work. But you know, if you got them in your lawn and they're in one patch, I got 3 acres, with about a quarter acre in two patches combined. It was a total quarter acre that was really heavy with them in the worst conditions on the property. You do that, and then they grow. Except they have a time that they put on those burrs, and those burrs are a seed. The thing is, you don't really notice the burr unless you look for it until it's a problem. By the time it's a problem, it is a mature seed. Now think about it this way. You go out to your garden and you pick a cucumber. Not a great big cucumber, a little bitty baby cucumber, because everything tastes better as a baby, right? So you pick your little bitty cucumber and you cut it open, and all those little immature seeds, you pull them out, you dry them, you try to plant them. What happens? Nothing. The seeds are not yet mature. So nothing happens. So what do you think you do? What's the mechanical control? Mowing. And so what you do is you watch the places where you know where you've identified the problem, and you watch them grow, and you let them grow, and you don't mow. Because if you mow that area before the time is right, what'll end up happening is you knock things down and they'll start growing more prostrate instead of sticking up. And when they grow prostrate, then your grass grows up through them and they're perfectly protected under there. And then you go out by and you mow your grass like a good grass manager, and you only take the top inch off the grass. And your mower is set too high to get the seed heads, which are now prostrate, meaning they're growing laterally out because of repeated mowing. So the place where you know they are, you want to not mow, and you want to let it grow high, and you want to give it fertility and irrigation. You want to watch your sand spur plants. Learn to identify the plant itself. And you'll start to see the heads form, the seeds form, just like you're looking at wheat. And you see the heads on the wheat before it's actually mature. Then you take thy mower. You lower thy blade until you're almost so low you're committing an atrocity. Maybe one level up, maybe all the way down, depending on your mower. And you mow it before it goes into the reproduction cycle. And then you add more fertility and more irrigation, because now you have sinned against the grass and the lawn because you've cut it really short, probably in one of the hotter parts of your year. So you want to take care of it. And it might take you 2 or 3 years of that approach. And you'll see a bunch this year, less next year, less next year, and then gone if you stay on it. That's how I did it here. And I'm telling you, literally people called it a sand burr farm. There isn't one here. I haven't seen one forever. Now we have those damn beggar's lice things, but they don't hurt. They're just annoying. I have not seen a sand spur here in 4 or 5 years. It took about 4 or 5 years after I figured out the code. Like, they started to go down in population from the fertility boost from the birds, right? But it was when I thought of, like, I got to get rid of this shit. And the fertility alone wasn't working. And I just sat down one day, had a beer on the back porch, and talked to the dog about the problem. Talking to your dog is a good way to work through problems, because they just sit there and listen at you and look at you like they're paying attention, so you feel good about it, so you keep working on it. And that's when I came up with timing the mowing. And as soon as I started timing the mowing, the population just through the ground, right? That's the way to do it. And Kevin's asking, the spurs are seeds, right? Yes, they are. All right, that wraps it up for today. I don't have an item of the day for you. I got kind of behind this morning. I do appreciate it, though, when you guys do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. No matter what you buy, you help us out. We got great feedback on the book from so many people, but if that little girl's letter to me doesn't make you realize the opportunity in putting that book in the hand of a teenager, I don't know what will. So if you haven't picked up copies of Laws of Life yet for the young people in your life, to give them the advantage that you didn't have of somebody like me laying out what made my life work, do it. It's the best $17 you'll ever invest in a young person. If you do it for three and one reason, you'll feel like I do. It was worth it. And I feel like it, after all the work that went into it, if that one person was impacted, it was worth it. Anyway, thank you guys. Take care. I have a really cool idea for a show tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about AI in a way that we haven't. A way that I just used it. And I'm going to tell you how to use it that way. And it's really cool. And it's because a lot of you guys are not former military mechanics who are not, you know, immune to being bullshitted by a dealership telling you what service your vehicle needs. What if you had a personal asshole like me? And it could be your car, could be your AC system, could be any expensive thing in your life that you need work done on that you're not highly informed about. Like, it needs this. You know, your air conditioning system is just so out of date, you're better off spending $20,000 and putting in a whole new system. Oh, your car, it needs this special ES600 fuel injection cleaning. That needs attention today. And they just send you a text message, and you're supposed to just click it and say, okay, there's $300 of money that didn't need to be spent. What if you had a personal asshole? This is actually a joke idea that my buddy David and I had for a business. It works like this. You go to mypersonalasshole.com and you submit your bid, your service report, whatever it is, and one of our personal assholes picks up the phone and calls the provider for you and says, why are you doing this? Do you really need to replace the rotors for this brake job? Really? Did metal touch metal? Who says you need to do this? What do you mean you have to? Other questions like that that assholes like me would ask. Now, the thing is, like our revenue model, we were just spitballing, drinking some martinis and saying, oh, we take 10% of what we save you or whatever. But it was never scalable to a business that way. It didn't make sense. Trying to convince the person that needs the service that we were helping them out anyway, you know, just not, there's other things we could do to make more money. So it's just a fun, funky idea to talk about. And because honestly, I enjoy it. I love, here's another example that happened one time. My wife and I went to the dealership to have some work done for a problem the vehicle had. This was not routine service. It was, though, under warranty. Because I like to test things. I let my wife go in there all by her sweet self. And the guy comes out and says, yeah, you're right. It does need this. It does need it. And she says, so that's a warranty, right? He goes, no, I don't think this is going to be under warranty. He goes, no, this is not warranty work. But it absolutely was. She knew it was. So she just gets let him keep digging the hole. And she goes, are you sure? Can you check? Yeah, I can check. So then all of a sudden, I walk up. And he kind of looks at me like, oh, he must be waiting on me. He goes, I'll get to you in a second. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no, you'll get to me now. He's still confused. And she goes, that's my husband. And I swear to God, this guy looked like a kid that got caught by his dad. Like, he's looking at his toes, and he's like, moving is one, you know, like when you're trying to ask a girl out and you're 14 and she might say no. So you kind of like start moving your toe back and forth on it. Like he starts acting like literally like that. And I'm like, but you do know this is warranty, right? He goes, well, I'll have to check. Maybe your warranty's expired. I'm like, you do know this is a vehicle on a 2-year lease because it says right there on the top of your thing, because we're customers and we get our service done when we lease our vehicles, that's the case, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's under 3 years. Yeah. And you know the mileage because you wrote it down when you pulled it in, right? Yeah. So, you know, your standard warranty on things like this is 3 years and 36,000 miles, right? Yeah. So there's absolutely no way that you're not sure about that, is there? And all kinds of shit. Now, I'm going to tell you that those are some of my favorite moments when I get to read the riot act to somebody. And I don't yell at them and I don't call them a scumbag or whatever. I just start asking questions that I already know the answer to. What if you had that on demand? I mean, I'm literally thinking of making like a user's guide for this for various niches and maybe selling it for $8 on the website. But I'm going to do it all in a podcast tomorrow and tell you how to do it, how to formulate your prompts. And the shit I found that Toyota was just trying to pull, I'm like,
you know, I know a lot of shit, but I don't know what an ES600, you know, fuel injection cleaning is. But I'm thinking a vehicle running perfectly with 30,000 miles probably doesn't need one for $300. Turns out it's just a bunch of bullshit. They hook your vehicle up to this thing called an ES600, and it basically runs off fuel injector cleaner for about 30 minutes. My vehicle doesn't need that. It doesn't need that at all. And is bad. I'm going to have a meeting with these people. The head service writer, the shop manager, the technician, and the salesman I've bought four vehicles from, we're all going to sit down and have a conversation with each other. And this was already going to be an interesting conversation. But, oh, my God, friends, the things that ChatGPT gave me to say and to point out, and the maintenance schedule at 30,000 miles by the manufacturer, which they claim to be following, I have a printout of it. None of that shit's on there. Flushing the brake fluid at 30,000 miles, and not on there. That was another $300 they wanted. $80 to change an air cleaner. At least that's on the schedule. $80 to change a $24 air cleaner that literally is two clips and done. Something I could teach a 9-year-old to do. My granddaughter is capable of that job. $80. Oh, by the way, the air filter, yeah, I had just changed it because I knew it was due. So it was a brand new air filter. Then the service light happened to come on right after my wife picked the vehicle up. Why? Because it was in a little bit before service was due, like a couple hundred miles. So that service light just runs, if it's not reset, runs on the odometer. And what was she told when she called and said that she wanted to reset it? Oh, we can't reset that. That means something in your vehicle needs attention. No, what it needs is toggle the settings and hit reset reminder. It's not a sensor. It's basically a timer that runs off the odometer. They lied about that too. They're effed. I want to teach you how to do this, even if you don't know which end of the screwdriver to point at the screw. That's what's coming tomorrow. And I see a whole little side, like my little personal asshole business model. I don't necessarily see a business in it, but I see like each family, you know, having a consultant that knows how to do this so that, you know, Uncle Fred calls you and goes, they're telling me I need this. Well, maybe you don't, Uncle Fred. Let me see. Because there's way too much of this shit going on. And this should be a fun episode tomorrow. So that's what you have to look forward to. I'll catch you when we have it tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon. Are they gonna bail you out? Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month.